check,
going
check,
down,
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 check, check, check.
Yes.
Is it going? Is it moving?
Is it?
Is it better?
I don't know.
No?
In October of 2020, I interviewed two Christian singers, Meredith Andrews.
Hey. Hey.
And Mandisa.
Hey!
Whoa.
She got to start
Come
shouting.
Come on, shut the
We laughed a lot, and I knew the story I wanted from them, and I got it really quickly. But when I was wrapping up the interview, Meredith started opening up about her family's visit to a Nashville shopping mall, Opry Mills.
Last week, we were at Opry Mills on Wednesday night during a shooting. Mm-hmm. And my husband was with my boys in one store. And then my daughter and I were in Old Navy across the mall. My daughter and I actually didn't hear the gunshots, but my husband is always on high alert with stuff like that. He's just wired that way. And as soon as he heard the gunshots, he just dropped everything, grabbed my boys, started running. And my youngest son, who's 7, Remy, he just said out loud, "I really don't want to die today."
Audible. Audible. Audible.
Hi, my name is Rob Vischer. You're listening to the 6th episode of my new podcast, Audible God. In every new episode, you've heard stories of ordinary people who claim they heard from God. You've reached the last episode of season 1. If you want more stories / more episodes, hit subscribe, write a 5-star review, and tell us you want more. Today, you're going to hear about a dad who asked God to tell him whether his family was safe or dead. Meredith Andrews' husband, Jacob, was helping their two boys try on shoes in Journeys, a shoe store in Opry Mills Mall, when he heard gunshots. He dropped the shoes, grabbed his boys, and ran. This is Jacob.
We were in Journeys looking at shoes, and I heard two gunshots super close. Sounded like a 9mm, 15, 20 yards away. I grabbed the boys, and I darted in the back, and I heard about 5 or 6 more gunshots as we ran. We ran through the back of the store, away from the mall, where all the kiosks are, which is where the shooting seemed to be coming from. There was a worker from Gurney's in the back, and he was blocking the way, and he was saying, "You can't be back here," and I essentially pushed him over and just yelled, "Shooter." That opened up into this back hallway where workers go in between the back entrances of stores, and people were starting to flood in there and run. We found this emergency exit. That alarm will sound, pushed it open, the alarm sounded, and I thought we'd be on the outside, but we were in that weird little U section of the mall by Rainforest Cafe. So we had to run, and we found the exit by Ralph Lauren. We got to the outside of the mall. I called Meredith. She didn't pick up.
I'm wired a lot like Jacob. High alert, ready to protect. When I'm worried about my wife and she doesn't pick up her phone, my mind begins to work through every scenario so fast, life becomes slow motion and all my senses intensify. I begin hearing every footstep outside and every distant siren.
Me and the boys knelt down, we prayed. They were freaking out at that point. They were in hysterics. And we prayed, we got them settled down, called Meredith. She picked up. She had no clue what was going on. The news, all this hadn't hit the other side of the mall yet. And my adrenaline's on 11. And I'm like, "You have to get out of the mall now. Do whatever you have to do. Get out of the mall. There's a shooter. Go out the back. Don't go into the mall." She's like, "Okay." I was like, "I'll meet you. I'll meet you at the back of Old Navy." Me and the boys are at Ralph Lauren. Maverick doesn't have any shoes on, but we ran from Ralph Lauren all the way over to H&M where the van was parked. My 10-year-old barefoot, just trooper. Remy and Maverick, just little troopers. Sucking it up. We get to the van. I realize I don't have the keys. And so we get as far away from the mall as we can while still being in the parking lot. I call Meredith and she's like, "They have us locked in the back."
By that time, they're ushering people into the back room in Old Navy and there's about 30 of us just in a holding pattern.
And I'm like, "Well, I'm going to try and get an Uber or something and see if I can get close to the back of Old Navy and just kind of see if y'all can get out." So right as I was talking, I got off the phone and right by us, I noticed this vehicle, and inside the vehicle was a girl, early 20s.
So Jacob knocks on the window of this girl's car, a complete stranger.
And I was like, do you know what's going on? She's like, no. And I told her what's going on. And she said, well, do you want to get in the car? Are you guys okay? So we got in the car. Me and the boys got in the back seat. And I told her my wife and my daughter were stuck in Old Navy. Obviously, I want to go get my Meredith and Frankie. But also, I realize I'm dragging this complete stranger into this situation when the only smart and safe thing is to get away. I asked her if she'd let me get in the driver's seat, and she gets in the back seat with the boys, and if we can drive to the back of Old Navy and let me get Meredith and Frankie out. And so she's like, yeah. So we pull up to the back. I call Meredith, and she's like, they're not letting anybody leave. And I was like, how old are the employees? Meredith was like, about 16. I'm like, you're leaving.
Jacob, Meredith, and their three kids made it out of Opry Mills alive and unharmed. All they lost was a couple pair of kids' shoes and Journeys. In fact, since it was a targeted, gang-related shooting, everybody except one man made it out of the mall unharmed. But out of the thousands of people who escaped the mall that day, Meredith and Jacob's story is unique. Not because of what happened during the shooting, but because of what happened weeks before the shooting.
My husband actually had a dream this summer about a shooting happening on our property in our house. And he saw our kids were there, but our kids weren't harmed. But there were people that were shot on our property. And he said that he saw me come out and tend to them. And he came up to me and said,
are the kids okay? And she looked at me completely calm. She's like, we're fine. We're totally fine. And I woke up from the dream, and God very clearly said, if you will stay under the covenant of marriage, if you will stay married, you will be protected. And the danger will come very close, but it won't touch you.
And he had told me that. And then I had a dream, which I'm not as much of a dreamer as he is, but I had a dream soon after that of the shield, and all these darts were flying against our family, but everything was bouncing off the shield. I don't know if y'all have ever, and this might be even kind of controversial bringing up, I don't even know if y'all have ever seen Harry Potter, the very last movie,
yeah.
But as they're defending Hogwarts, the shield goes up. Somebody like puts a shield around the castle, mm-hmm. the school, and that's what I saw.
I'm not a Harry Potter fan. I actually think it's pretty lame. But I did look up this scene on YouTube. Spoiler alert. In the last Harry Potter movie, Voldemort, the bad guy, burns down the shield of protection, which isn't super reassuring. But the shield Meredith dreamt about wasn't a shield made of magic. To Meredith, it was a clear symbol of God's protection.
It wasn't surprising to me. It was like we both kind of had this awareness or heads up a little bit.
Jacob and Meredith dreamed about violence hitting close to home. Jacob dreamed more literally of a shooting. Meredith dreamed more symbolically of a Harry Potter style shield protecting their home. But each of their dreams assured them that they and their kids would be protected. When violence struck Opry Mills, they were mentally ready, and they found each other in less than an hour. Their story is how I like things to happen. Prior warning, no bystanders hurt. Everybody reunites within an hour, and the shooter goes to prison. Unfortunately for one student at a Bible college in Kentucky, there were no warning dreams or quick reunions, just sudden violence and unthinkable tragedy. But let's not start there. Let's go back to where all college students begin. Freshman year. This is one of those freshmen, Mary King.
He and I started out as freshmen together at Kentucky Mountain Bible College. And so here he was, kind of old enough to be my parent. I met him the first day of classes, and I just remember he's short in stature. I'm 5'3", and he's probably every bit of 5'1", maybe. He had a really thick accent, so he was hard to understand. So I didn't really like talk to him a whole lot at first when he first came. And I thought, who is this dude? You know, coming from Africa and coming to school in his 40s. I was just like, wow.
This dude was John Gakwaya, or Pastor John.
I have been pastoring since 1975 through 1989. And then from 1989, I became superintendent until 1992. Then in 92, I came here to school.
By here, he means
Kentucky Mountain Bible College.
A very strict Christian Bible college of less than 100 students tucked away in the hills of eastern Kentucky.
I was told that I would stay only 2 years and go back to Rwanda. When I got here, they said, okay, we see you transcribe everything. It looks like you are going to stay another year so that you can be graduating from here. I was concerned. I told my wife that I would be staying only 2 years. Now you are adding another year. What is going on? Well, that's how it needs to be.
So right away, there's a huge misunderstanding. Because of a mix-up with Pastor John's transcripts, the staff at his new Bible college told him he would have to stay an extra year to graduate. At that point, if I were Pastor John, I would have peaced out and gone back to Rwanda. But he stayed because... My feeling was God wants it to be happening like this. Because Pastor John believed God was in control of everything, even a huge misunderstanding, he was willing to roll with almost anything, including massive lifestyle changes. Here's Mary again.
Our every moment was managed by bells. You had a waking bell. You had a 5-minute chapel warning bell. Every class, the bell rang. The bell rang for work hour. The bell rang 5 minutes before supper. You better be there when they said the blessing for the food or you weren't going to eat. It was very, very structured. When I describe it to non-church going people, they go, oh, you went to military college.
Pastor John is Rwandan. In Rwanda, time is a little more fluid and scheduling is a little less specific than it is in the U.S. So why was he at a strict Holiness Bible College that can easily be mistaken for military college? Turns out, all the students on campus were asking that same question.
And we all wanted to know, why would this man come halfway across the world to come to college at our little bitty college? One of the guys asked one of the faculty or staff, like, where did Pastor John come from? How did he hear about the college? And they say Pastor John is coming back to college to study to be a leader, to be a pastor, a better, more effective pastor. And they're like, wow.
So did Pastor John attend Kentucky Mountain Bible College because his church back in Rwanda was failing? Well, you decide.
Pastor John had actually started a church in Rwanda by discipling about 11 men. And the number may be wrong. It might be 11, it might be 13, but it was something like that. And he grew that church by discipling those men to over 1,200. And the guys that were all going into the pastoral studies were like, he needs to be on staff telling us how to grow a church.
In 1992, I attended New Covenant Living with my parents, a church of 300 in Jackson, Michigan. I would have considered a church of 1,200 to be a mega church. Today, by most standards, 1,200 is still considered a large church. So I repeat, why did this successful Rwandan pastor end up at Kentucky Mountain Bible College? Well, it's all who you know. Some missionaries from the Bible College, Martha and Jim Kirkpatrick, had befriended Pastor John in Rwanda, and they recommended the school to him. And it was obvious he just wanted to learn.
Everybody likes to talk about their war stories. Everybody likes to say, well, when I was in the war, and pastors were the same way, you know, well, when I first started pastoring, you know, or when I was in the pastorate over here, and they like to tell stories. Pastor John never told stories about being in the pastorate. He always wanted to learn. He always wanted to ask questions. He never mentioned really about his pastorate, how he grew his church, how successful it was. And if you would ask him, he would just laugh and just brush it off and use hand motions and like motion you away. Like, no, I don't know anything. I am here to learn. I am a student.
So an influential Rwandan pastor in his 40s gives up his culture's way of doing things, his comfort, and his influence to go to a strict Bible college as a non-traditional student. At my Christian college, we always saw older non-trads as outsiders. But even though Pastor John sported a different age, nationality, and skin color than 95% of the students, he never acted like an outsider.
I mean, he had no fear of getting to know all of his college students, even though we were of a different culture, we were a different skin color. He was a friend to everyone. I'm from Alaska, but he would always ask me about Alaska. Is it really cold there? Is it really, you know, do you have snow? And he would say, I have heard such things that the Eskimos live in an ice house. And I always thought that was so funny because I always wanted to know about African culture and, you know, did they really live in huts? And here he is asking me if we really lived in igloos.
Africans in huts, Eskimos in igloos, so many stereotypes flying around here. But neither of them was offended. In fact, they laughed a lot about their differences.
He was just trying to fit in with a bunch of college kids, like college age kids. He was a hoot sometimes. We were always laughing at him, laughing with him. And he knew he was not really the butt of our jokes, but just that he was part of the joke sometimes. And he would, you know, just laugh with us and cut up with us and try to be involved in the things that we were doing because obviously his family was absent.
Let's stop right here. Pastor John not only gave up his culture, his community, and his influence to attend Bible college, he also gave up 3 years with his family. His wife and 3 kids were still in Rwanda.
Pastor John was not one to ever really show visibly that he was ever discouraged or that he missed home. We could ask him, how is your family? And, you know, he would say, oh, I talked to them and they're doing good. And he never had a negative word to say about how hard it was, how much he missed his family. Everything was just, you know, God is good. I'm so blessed. He was known for his big smile.
During his first 2 years in Kentucky, the separation was definitely hard, but Pastor John could still have fun and bear the burden of missing his family with a smile until a few days after April 7th, 1994.
And then the genocide started 1994. While I was here in USA.
And then the genocide started. The Rwandan genocide. Pastor John's wife, Virginia, and his 3 kids, Theo, Timothy, and Grace, were still in Rwanda.
It was terrible. Many people had been killed. And I was thinking, I said, is any way I will see them again? What can I do? And then I heard that people were escaping, going to Congo and other countries. Then I wondered, where is my family now? How am I going to see them again? To tell you the truth, I didn't have hope.
I remember some of the faculty and staff talking about it. I didn't really understand the differences between the two tribes back then in Rwanda, the Hutu and the Tutsi. But I remember going to the newspapers and looking for articles and reading about it. And when they talked about it in chapel, like requesting prayer and stuff, I guess is when it first really hit me what all was going on.
So what was going on? This is a brief, probably overly simplistic summary of what happened. There are 2 major ethnic groups in Rwanda, the Hutus and the Tutsis. The Hutus hold the majority with 85% of the population. The Tutsis are definitely the minority, but for many years, they ruled the country through a monarchy. In 1959, the Hutus overthrew the Tutsis, and many Tutsis fled for their lives to other surrounding countries. In 1990, a group of Tutsi exiles united to form an army called the Rwandan Patriotic Front, or the RPF. They invaded Rwanda until a peace deal was reached in 1993. Now, fast forward to the night of April 6, 1994. The president of Rwanda and the president of Burundi, 2 Hutus, were flying in the same plane. It was shot down, and everyone in the plane died. Hutu extremists blamed the Tutsi-led RPF, and they carried out a well-planned massacre of over 800,000 Tutsi citizens over the course of 100 days. During the genocide, they carried machetes, guns, and radios. Radios blaring hate messages like weed out the cockroaches. Translation, kill the Tutsis.
You know, our ceiling dropped a couple of notches as the entire campus started learning about the genocide, about what was happening, you know, how it impacted Pastor John. But I remember and just feeling so, like, helpless.
Everybody on campus felt helpless. They wanted to reach out, but even their best intention questions were painful for Pastor John.
Teachers or students were asking me, so do you know where your family is? That was something killing me again. I said, no, I don't know. I don't know. I have not heard about them. I don't know where they are. I only God who knows where they are. But to me, I don't know anything.
A friend of Pastor John's who had escaped the genocide called Pastor John and gave him his only news about his family. And this is what he said.
No, we have not seen your family at all. What we do know, your house was completely destroyed. So we don't know where they are. We don't know if they died or not. But we do not know any information about them. I was like somebody who doesn't have any control at all in my mind. My mind was completely gone.
I worked in the kitchen at the Bible College, and I did a lot of the lunch prep, supper prep. If somebody was sick on campus, like one of the students, usually somebody from that floor or that dorm, a friend, a roommate, would be responsible to come down to the kitchen and get a tray for that person and take it up to them. The president of student council, his name was Eric, we had sent a tray up with him to Pastor John because Pastor John quit coming to meals. I was standing in the kitchen by the dishwasher, and Eric came back down with the tray. And we had like the little hotel covers, you know, the little domes that go over the food to keep it warm. And he came back down, and he was visibly upset. And I didn't really know why. I thought, I wonder what's wrong with him. And he kind of set the tray down close to where I was. And I said, what's wrong? And he said, Pastor John didn't eat his food. And I, you know, didn't even think anything of it because I wasn't putting all the elements together of what was going on in Pastor John's world. And then I noticed Eric was crying. And I lifted the lid to the plate and everything was perfectly intact as they had served it up. And I looked at Eric and I said, well, you know, if he doesn't eat this meal, we'll just send one up, you know, for supper or whatever. And Eric said, no, you don't understand. And he was then visibly crying, like really upset crying, weeping almost. And he just kind of crumbled emotionally into that weeping. And I said, what? And he said, this is about the fifth or sixth meal that he's refused. He's not eaten in a week. I was like, what? And then Eric started crying. And then I kind of stood there like, trying to understand what was going on in Pastor John's mind. And he said, when I go up there to leave a meal, he said he's on his face in the middle of his dorm room, weeping and praying for his family.
Pastor John didn't know where his family was. He didn't know how to help them, and he didn't even know if they were alive. And he felt like he was losing his mind. So he did the only thing he knew to do.
So I spent time praying and praying and praying. I really prayed.
And the whole campus joined him.
The guys would, after meal times or in the evenings, they could hear Pastor John weeping on his face in his dorm room. And several of the guys would gather around them and put their hands on him, lay hands on him and pray with him. And then the boys from the dorm would just pour out of his room in the doorway, out in the hallway, and they'd all be praying with Pastor John and just trying to help him bear his burden, you know, for his family.
Pastor John missed classes because he couldn't focus. He missed meals because of his fast. He was losing weight. He was losing sleep. And like I said before, he even wondered if he was losing his mind. In that desperate state, he finally asked God for a sign that his family was still alive. More specifically, he asked to see them all together in a dream.
From April up to the end of May 94, really, I was not sleeping at all. I was waking up and wondering what to do and Nothing. But I remember when I slept, it was on 28th May of 94. I went, just lay down like this. And then I really slept completely. I saw my wife and holding three kids and then seeing them face to face like this. See each one of them. Seeing Virginia and Timothy and Theophile and then Chris. Seeing them together. They were telling me, oh, the war was, everybody fled away and seeing and then it cut out. So they were telling me the story, how they ran away and everything. After that, I woke up.
Before he went to sleep, Pastor John asked God to give him a specific dream to show him his family was still alive. And he had that dream. Pastor John was pumped, but everybody else on campus was a little bit more hesitant.
This is where I started to tell all teachers or students where I saw my family and then everything, God will make it, someday you will see them here.
And they said,
did you talk to your wife? And I said, yes, through dreams. After dreaming this and seeing them, really in my heart, I said, I will see them. There was a confirmation that since I saw them talking to each other, they will be here. There was no doubt at all. That's where I became that I was very happy and going to school as normal. I knew that I would see them again.
The first time we noticed that change was when he came to a meal, because that was when he broke his fast and he actually showed up in the dining hall. And I remember everybody's like elbowing and going, Pastor John's here, Pastor John's here. Pastor John came to lunch. Pastor John came to a meal.
Pastor John had the dream on
28th May of 94.
But he hadn't heard from his family for over 51 days.
June, July, August, no word at all from them.
The count grew from 51 days to 5 months. And still, Pastor John believed he would see them on campus.
One of the teachers asked me, he said, John, you said that you saw your wife and the kids. Yes. So are you sure that you will see them again? I said, yes. Brother, I will see them face to face someday. They will be in this campus. And so this teacher was spreading the news to other teachers and so forth. You know, John said that his family will be in this campus someday.
The first stage of the grieving process, denial. He went from being depressed, weeping, and fasting to quickly getting back to his bubbly old self. And instead of cheering with him and getting excited for him, many on campus pitied him.
Some of them were doubting, saying, maybe this man is going to become crazy.
I think there was a concern that we had not physically heard news from his family that they were safe. And I do remember them feeling like, I hope he's not let down. Like if he gets news that his family hasn't made it or one of them's been killed or they've all been killed, I hope he's not wrong. And I hope that, you know, something bad hasn't happened.
And then September 30th, the president school came while I was eating lunch. He came, John, I have a message for you. He said, okay. Now we have 12:30. By 2 o'clock, come to my house. I said, all right. And then I said, oh, I wish it could be 2 o'clock now. You know, I was trying to push my watch and make it 2 o'clock, but it went to work. So when 2 o'clock arrived, I just ran to his house.
When Pastor John sprinted in, the president of the college handed the phone to him. And on the phone, he heard his old friend, Jim Kirkpatrick, the missionary who helped him enroll at Kentucky Mountain Bible College.
Jim said, John, we have a very special guest in my house here in Nairobi, in Kenya. So I said, who are those guests? Well, I don't want to tell their names, but maybe you will hear from them. I said, Jim, you need to tell me who are those guests. You know, I was anxious, but I was hoping maybe she might be my wife or kids. I don't know. He was saying, John, don't be anxious. You will hear from them. Okay, and then after that, maybe he took a phone he gave to them. And then I said, hello. And my wife said, hello. Just like, who is this? I was familiar with the voice of my wife, how she speaks strongly. But she was talking like a baby. I said, are you Virginia or who are you? And they said, she said, yeah, we got here and the kids are still sleeping.
The Rwandan genocide lasted 100 days. During all 100 of those days, and 75 days beyond, Pastor John hadn't heard anything from or about his wife and kids. But by day 51, Pastor John knew his whole family was alive because of a dream that God gave him.
I wasn't there physically when he got the news, but I remember, I'm not sure which student it was, but one of the students came running down the hill and came busting up in the dorm and saying, Pastor John's family is safe. And literally the entire campus was in celebration with Pastor John. That man, you could not have tied him down with an anchor. Though he be little, he was floating on clouds, and probably glowing would be the right word. For as dark-skinned as Pastor John is, that man glowed. He had a little shouting fit at one point, and I remember all teeth. That man had white teeth. I just remember seeing the smile from ear to ear and him fist pumping the air saying, God is good. God is good. He can be trusted. God is good. And just being so happy.
Usually, this is where the Audible God theme music would play. It's the perfect end to a beautiful story. But not today. There's too many small stories worth telling that happened after this moment. So I decided to share just one with you from Mary.
They told us to please give the family space to process everything that they had been through. And they had told us to, you know, they'd probably witnessed things, horrific, you know, dead bodies, massacre, you know, all the things that they went through to get over here. And they told us to just, you know, rather than be over there trying to introduce ourselves and everything, to just let them adapt slowly and they would integrate and become a part of the community when they were ready. And I just felt like, I don't know, in my heart, I was like, oh my goodness, if that were me, I'd want somebody to come over and hug my neck and welcome me. And so I got the kids markers and paper and balloons and just some stuff, cheap stuff at Dollar General, and knocked on the door. I snuck up there. I looked around over my shoulder, make sure nobody's going to say, hey, what are you doing? And I knocked on the door, and of course, I couldn't speak to them. They couldn't speak to me. I showed Virginia what I had in my arms and stuff, and she opened the door and let me in, and I couldn't talk, and I just kind of like motioned for the kids to come over, and I started making paper airplanes and coloring with the markers and stuff, and just, we had a blast the first time I was up there, even though we couldn't even communicate or speak. We had fun. I know that much. I just wanted to be with them. I just wanted to, you know, I knew they had left everything they had known. I knew they didn't have any family in the States, and I've been adopted and didn't have a lot of family myself. And I think maybe I was looking for a place to belong just as much as they were, in a way. And so we just kind of connected, and I've been family ever since.
When Mary says, I've been family ever since, she's not exaggerating.
When we had graduation, of course, Virginia was there and for Pastor John, and I walked across to get my diploma, you know, in the same class as Pastor John. And they asked for different family members, you know, when the graduate walked across to receive their diploma, they asked for, would the family of, you know, Pastor John Gakwaya, please stand. And of course, you know, his daughter and two sons in Virginia stood, and my adopted mother and my aunt were there for my graduation, and they stood for Pastor John in Virginia. And when I walked across the platform to get my diploma, Virginia and the kids stood for me.
This is the sixth and final episode of Audible God's first season. And here's what I've learned so far. I don't believe every person who says, God told me. But out of the people I do believe, some of them have dreams. Some of them receive unshakable knowings of what they should do next. And some of them get small creative ideas, like painting a portrait for a friend, or bringing markers, papers, and balloons to a new family with kids. After six episodes, I'm convinced that the only one who makes it hard to hear God's voice is me. When I give up my agenda, my goals, and my dreams, God begins to give me His. And it doesn't matter to me if He speaks audibly or not, because when I'm open to hearing Him, He speaks to me in a way that I can understand.
Audible.
Thanks to Way Nation's video rock star, Daniel Mick Jaggers, and the rest of the Way Nation team for helping with this podcast. The theme music is brought to you by me and Joe Supersize Fry. And thanks to Mandisa, Meredith Andrews, Jacob Suter, Mary, and Pastor John Gakwaya for sharing your stories. You can find more fun and meaningful podcasts, videos, and blogs on waynation.com. God. If you have an Audible God story, I want to hear from you like a grandparent waiting for a birth announcement. Go to audiblegod.com now and share your story with me. Again, go to audiblegod.com and drop a story on me like deep bass at a dubstep concert. If you want your in-laws to stream it so you'll finally have something to talk about besides politics, it's up to you. Click subscribe, write a 5-star review, then text the first in-law that comes to mind and say, hey, you got to listen to the Audible God podcast. It's audible, all done. Unless you demand another season.
And I remember talking to her, and she said, well, yes, Meddy. She said, you are our family now. She used to say, you are like my daughter. And I said, well, I've never had a dad. And then she said, well, very well. She said, Pastor John will be your father then, your Rwandan father. So whenever they call me, they always say, Mary, it's your African mother. It's your Rwandan father. And he called me my daughter. So he called me just a week ago to see how my husband was doing. And he said, hello, Mary. He said, it is your African father. And he said, it's so good to hear from you, my daughter.